News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. One of the biggest New Hampshire headlines of the week actually came from Vermont, with the announcement that after more than four decades in operation, the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant will shut down late next year. The news stunned many on both sides of the Connecticut River, especially those who'd long argued about the facility's role in Vermont and New England. The parent company of Vermont Yankee, Louisiana-based Entergy Corporation, said the decision was based on pure economics. Electricity prices driven lower by natural gas, combined with high costs of running the plant. But politics may also have played a role. Entergy and the state of Vermont have been locked in a three-year battle over whether the plant should be allowed to continue. Now attention will turn to what's called decommissioning, the extensive process of shutting it down, as well as the impact on Vermont Yankee's more than 600 workers, the state's economy, and New England's energy supplies. There was plenty of news in New Hampshire this week as well, as August wraps up. At our state house, several special summer study committees continued their work, including those looking at Medicaid expansion, gambling regulation, and problems with PSNH's power plants. Also, right after Labor Day, the state Senate will vote on a new president, and by all accounts, it will be Republican Chuck Morse of Salem. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and let's hear from you. We'd like your comments on these stories and other headlines that grabbed your attention this week. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We have three guests with me in studio, Kevin Landrigan, political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. Kevin, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Great to be back, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean Spiliotis, welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Josh Rogers, NHPR State House reporter. And Josh, thanks for making the time.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and gentlemen, I do want to start out with the Vermont Yankee story. And for more on that, we're going to go now to our colleague, John Dillon. He's a reporter for Vermont Public Radio. He's been following this issue for a long time. John, thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, on this side of the Connecticut River anyway, we were pretty surprised. How surprised were you?
Not totally surprised. I was thinking it was more a matter of when, not if, this plant would close, just because of the real change in the energy market that we've seen because of natural gas. Other nuclear plants have closed in recent years. There was one in Wisconsin, the Kewaunee plant, an older single-unit reactor like Vermont Yankee. So there were signs. There were also Wall Street was indicating that Entergy was losing money. Entergy itself was indicating it was losing money on Vermont Yankee because back in March it devalued, it lowered the value of the plant on its books by about three times. It reduced the value to $162 million. So that was a clear sign that this plant wasn't making money for the company.
Well, and Entergy did cite those economic factors, the price of electricity and the stock and so forth. But was it pure economics or was there a political element to this, John?
Well, as you know, Governor Shumlin and Vermont Governor Shumlin and the Democratic majority in Vermont have not favored nuclear power. So it wasn't embraced by the political leaders in the state since about 2010, when the Vermont legislature decided not to extend the operating license. And that obviously got challenged in federal court and the state lost. But it was clearly less of a welcoming political environment for Vermont Yankee. But I think more than that, leading into that whole 2010 debate, the state's utilities decided, perhaps in part because of the politics facing Vermont Yankee, not to engage in a long-term power contract. So that meant that Yankee didn't have a 20-year or 10-year even contract for some of its power. So it was then forced to play in the open market where natural gas has lowered the prices substantially. So it's tied together, but I think you have to take Bill Moll, the Entergy president for nuclear operations, who delivered the news here, at his word that the bottom line was the bottom line, and it just was not making any money. He said it was clear the plant will not be be profitable.
What was the response to this news, John, among those Vermonters who fought on both sides of this issue?
You know, there wasn't a lot of celebration. The governor had a news conference the morning this was announced. He was surrounded by House and Senate leaders, and they said that time now, you know, move on. We have to help the 650 workers there. The economic development folks in southern Vermont and the Brattleboro area are really concerned because these are jobs that you just can't walk down the street and find a new opening. You know, they're highly trained, but they're also highly specialized positions. So they're worried about that. They're also very well-paying jobs. They're also trying to figure out how to use that site down the road for other industrial development or maybe even another power plant. But it was, you know, the reaction kind of fell predictably. The anti-nuclear people were happy but said the focus now is safe decommissioning.
Yeah, and more than 600 people work there on both sides of the river. So you're
right.
Those jobs are hard to replace. What does this mean, John, for the regional electric grid? As we know, you know, power isn't produced state by state. It's produced regionally and then dumped into a common pool, so to speak.
Well, there won't be a shortage of electricity. ISO New England, which oversees the grid, put out a statement the day of the closing or the day of the announcement and said, this is 605 megawatts going offline at the end of next year, but there's still ample supply. In terms of grid stability, they had been concerned. A study several years ago had pointed to perhaps some disruption, some weakness in the grid without that energy source located in southeastern Vermont. But then a subsequent study last year found that they could manage without Vermont Yankee online. So they kind of tried to reassure everybody that the lights won't flicker and that the grid will be just as stable without this unit.
Well, John, thank you very much. We really appreciate you being with us.
You're very welcome.
That's John Dillon, reporter for Vermont Public Radio, updating us on one of the big stories of this week. Again, that's the closure of the Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant by late next year. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Your thoughts, questions, comments about some of the top stories of the week. And Kevin Landrigan, hearing about what's happening with Vermont Yankee makes me wonder also about what may be happening with some of New Hampshire's nuclear power plant, the one nuclear power plant here in New Hampshire. Been a lot of talk about divestiture of public service of New Hampshire's power plants. Are we talking about nuclear or are we talking about the coal plants? What's going on here in New Hampshire in terms of that?
Yeah, we're talking about the coal plant, three coal plants that Public Service Company of New Hampshire owns in Bow and on the seacoast. There's no plans to divest Seabrook, their nuclear plant, which has, by the way, a very different economic profile than Vermont Yankee. One is twice the size of Vermont Yankee. It has a long-term agreement with the power New England Power Grid. It's financially much more secure and hasn't had some of the operational problems that Seabrook had. But back to the State House, with regard to these plants, there's been a lot of discussion initially about whether public service should be forced to divest or sell off these fossil fuel-burning plants. And it's amazing to how things have changed in a couple of years. With natural gas prices so low, As recently as 4 or 5 years ago, these plants were operating at full capacity. Now they're only operating around 50, at most 60% capacity now because of the cheap price of gas out there in the market.
So it's cheaper to burn natural gas than coal.
Much cheaper right now. But public service wants to hold on to these plants because they're reliable sources, and they also diversify their energy supply. And a legislative committee this week essentially that is studying this issue broadly decided we have more questions than we do answers about selling off these plants. The biggest question, obviously, is what happens to PSNH customers when you try and sell them off? The utility is going to be entitled to recover what are called stranded costs, all the costs they've spent to maintain and operate these plants over the years. Those run into the hundreds of millions of dollars.
So who pays? Ratepayers, taxpayers, investors?
Right. And in all likelihood, ratepayers would have to pay at least a portion, if not much, of that cost. And that could cause PSNH rates to skyrocket. As we know right now, PSNH is losing customers to competitive suppliers who are offering lower rates. So it's such an unknown and such a dangerous prospect for consumers and for taxpayers that the legislature essentially punted this week on going forward with any kind of bill to divest.
Dean, you want to jump in real quick?
Sure. You know, and the issue really is ultimately about what it ends up costing customers. You know, PSNH is really being pinched here. They have these coal fire plants that they're not using all that frequently because of the price of natural gas. They put in this big mercury scrubber system at the Merrimack station that's, I think, cost some over $400 million. There's now some discussion about how that's going to be paid for, and I think they're waiting for permission from the Public Utility Commission to pass that cost on to consumers. So finally, as Kevin mentioned, a lot of consumers are going to these other suppliers. So this joint oversight committee that met this week, because I think this is the third meeting for the summer, essentially said we're not in a position to make that decision. We need to kick that down the road a little bit. But this is an ongoing concern with ultimately what a loss of customers and an increase in rates to compensate for these costs.
Yeah, and there's also been a political component, right, Josh? I mean, some of the voices that called for electric deregulation way back when are now looking at the current situation and giving us a different thought on it.
Well, you know, it's a complicated issue, and I do think that it was hard for people to anticipate what was going to happen with natural gas prices. And
absolutely.
Yeah, just even looking out the window from our studios here, you can see the many days at the Bow Power Plant is not running. To Kevin's point, PSNH folks would say, you know, it's important that we're well positioned to weather, you know, the vicissitudes of an energy market, and having these multiple options are helpful. But, you know, the reality is that 55% of PSNH's customer in terms of demands, which mean mainly commercial customers, have left PSNH. And, you know, that creates a dynamic that has people understandably worried. And you do have people, Jeb Bradley, state Senate Majority Leader. He was in the House of Representatives back when deregulation went through his committee and was one of the architects of that. You know, he's eyeing higher office. And he's certainly somebody who, you know, sort of got rather heated with PSNH President Gary Long at a past Energy Oversight Committee meeting. You know, Gary Long's going to be on the hot seat. He's going to be deposed over the cost of the scrubber that Dean mentioned and whether PSNH has the ability to recoup all of the $420-odd million it spent, which was twice the estimate, and how that's going to shake out. So this isn't going away, and the action by the committee this week suggested that there's going to be a lot of questions into the winter.
And more after a short break. Stay with us.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And you're invited to join NHPR in the Music Hall in Portsmouth as we kick off a new season of Writers on a New England Stage. Our own Virginia Prescott will be sitting down with a group of noted authors, including Margaret Atwood, Bill Bryson, and Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Take a look at the full schedule and get your tickets at NHPR.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Dick Thaxton Realtor, helping customers throughout the process of selling and buying homes in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Vermont for over two decades. On the web at dickthaxton.com. And Seacoast Orthopedics and Sports Medicine hosting a community lecture on concussions in athletes with Dr. Fred Brennan, September 4th at 6 p.m. at Frisbee Hospital. SOSmed.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're looking at some of the top headlines this week, including the end to the long battle over Vermont Yankee's nuclear power plant that will shut down, the company said. We've also been looking at the issue of divestiture of PSNH's coal-fired plants. You can call us about those headlines and more at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And gentlemen, it's actually been a pretty busy week in politics. Here we are in that supposedly quiet week, Dean Spiliotis, just before Labor Day. But those who want higher office here in New Hampshire have been busy. In New Hampshire's 2nd Congressional District, Dean, one man's out, another plans to jump in, whole lot of names being floated. First of all, Bill O'Brien, former House Speaker, Republican from Mount Vernon, is not running after all for the 2nd Congressional District. What happened, Dean?
Well, he made the decision not to run. He had an exploratory committee, had been looking into it, had had some initially weak fundraising numbers, which I think didn't help, since Annie Custer will be well-funded as the incumbent in District 2. He instead decided to take a position as chief operating officer at a technology software security firm, which is something he has said he's been in that field for 25 years, and this was an opportunity he couldn't pass up. It's interesting. I almost think that the Custer folks are probably disappointed because he's been a very good fundraising item for them. He's out, which will probably make the race a lot less colorful and interesting in some respects. Gary Lambert, a one-term state senator from Nashua, he was in the Senate from 2010 to 2012, looks like he's getting in. He didn't run for re-election in 2012 in the Senate. He said he was going back into active duty as a colonel in the Marine Corps Reserve. There was this lawsuit in 2009 against the government for forcing a number of colonels to retire. They've now been reinstated, so he's going back into the reserves. He's a patent lawyer. We don't know a lot about him. A name recognition is going to be a big challenge for him, obviously. Some people have described him as leaning libertarian. Interestingly enough, Bill O'Brien said recently that he was unhappy that that Lambert had supported the regional greenhouse gas initiative changes, and also said he's not economically conservative enough. So there may be others that get into the race as well that others here could mention. I think, you know, it puts it, for whatever we might say about Annie Custer and how she's done in her first term, so far this is all relatively good news for her in terms of running for re-election. But we'll see how the race develops.
Well, and Josh Dean mentioned, you know, how Democrats might have been disappointed not to have Bill O'Brien to run against. How about Republicans? How did they react to Bill O'Brien saying, no, on second thought, I'm not going to do this?
Well, I think it depends on which ones you ask. And I think it, you know, for you know, if nothing else, the former House Speaker is a real lightning rod within his own party and, you know, outside his party. You know, for Democrats, he was a sort of embodiment of all the things that they don't want and choose to vilify. And for Republicans, you know, they liked some of what he did and they didn't like some of what he did in terms of the policy matters. You know, a lot of Republicans may not have liked the tone, but they certainly liked the budget Bill O'Brien got through the legislature. And, you know, they may have not liked the degree to which, you know, he became something that the Democrats could invoke as exactly what we don't want in New Hampshire. But at the same time, you know, Republicans, they've got a lot of seats. They've got a lot of, you know, they've got a slate they need to fill for the fall. And, you know, while it's not quite Labor Day, you know, the names that are out there, you know, Jim Rubens for U.S. Senate, Karen Testerman for U.S. Senate, Gary Lambert for CD2, and George Lambert for the governor's race, and maybe Andy Samberg for governor. That's not what at least the establishment Republicans would choose to have running. There's a bunch of time left, but it is a question whether or not, I mean, Republicans were thinking 2014 could be a good year. You know, the out years tend to be good for them, and they would have, you know, first-term governor to run against. Governor Hassan looks to be in good shape, and it's going to be interesting to see what sort of Republicans choose to throw their hat in the ring.
Well, let's talk about that. Kevin Landrigan, you had an article just recently that said GOP activists said among those who might consider getting into the race, this is again the second congressional district after Bill O'Brien said he's not going to do it, although Gary Lambert looks like he will. A couple names from your article, Kevin. Marilinda Garcia, Jim Bender, Jeannie Forrester, Robert O'Dell, and a businessman, Brian Sharp. Give us a sense of these folks and where they fit in the political spectrum.
Well, like Dean said, Gary Lambert doesn't have the name recognition or the access to big money. So it's really an invitation for a lot of grassroots conservative activists, people who consider themselves disciples of the O'Brien movement, if you will, to get into this race and challenge Lambert for the nomination. And I fully expect somebody will, in all likelihood, just because, as I say, Lambert doesn't have the obvious raw materials. But certainly, O'Brien's exit from the stage politically for the Republican Party is both good and bad, because on the one hand, a lot of establishment Republicans, Josh is right, say privately that absence in politics does not make the heart grow fonder. Now that he's no longer been Speaker, many of these folks who are heaping praise on him fully understand he contributed to the big losses in 2012. He contributed to losing the House, which was a big shock for the Republican Party in November 2012. But what you're losing is that star power, is somebody who generates a lot of publicity for the party, some of it negative, but keeps the GOP in the story. And to Josh's greater point, without a lot of big-name candidates running at the top of the ballot, Bill O'Brien was one of the only few, and now he's gone.
Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're looking at some of the top headlines of the week, and we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Okay, Kevin, so speaking of big names and star power, there has been, according to the New Hampshire Union Leaders, John DeStazo, more Scott Brown sightings in New Hampshire. The former Massachusetts senator, a Republican, moderate Republican, considering a run against New Hampshire's Democratic U.S. Senator Gene Shaheen. John reported that he was at the Hampton Casino Ballroom recently. In September, he's going to speak before the Nashua Lions Club. In October, there's another speech. Why Scott Brown for New Hampshire, Kevin?
Well, why Scott Brown for president? Why Scott Brown for Mass governor? This person who's been out of politics since he lost that special election for the U.S. Senate has obviously been looking for a political platform to stay relevant, and owning a summer house on the seacoast, as his family does, allows him to at least explore this run for the U.S. Senate.
Legally, you can do that. If you have a house in New Hampshire, you can run for U.S. Senate from New Hampshire.
Yes, you can.
Yeah. Dean.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we've talked about this before, the way in which in recent years kind of the political culture and the way in which media covers political races has led to the situation, as Kevin mentioned, where you often have people who are turned out of office or who maybe were in office holders at one point who now understand that simply by showing up in places or saying you're thinking about running generates all kinds of social media activity, blog posts, because there's a sort of insatiable desire for kind of political news. We all feed that. So, you know, he showed up in Iowa, so he got a lot of coverage about maybe he'll run for president. And then there was speculation about Massachusetts governor. Now he's been seen in New Hampshire. It's a way to keep yourself relevant. It's a way to kind of keep yourself in the mix until the right opportunity presents itself, either politically or lucratively in the private sector, either way, in terms of your influence. So I'm increasingly amused as I see not just Scott Brown, but a number of sort of political figures in our culture just kind of sort of time these appearances in different states to sort of maximize the platform that they're given for whatever they want to talk about. And I think, you know, maybe he will run, but I think his behavior to me seems very similar to some of these other folks who just kind of want to stay relevant.
Interesting.
Whether it's senatorial behavior to leap up on the stage with the sort of 70s, 80s rock band Cheap Trick wearing an American
flag.
Were
you at the casino ball?
No, I watched it on YouTube, though. And he leapt on the stage wearing an American flag T-shirt, brandishing a guitar that may or may not have been plugged in, and strummed along. It's interesting, but got a question. You know, he's also talked about running for governor of Massachusetts, and Charlie Baker, who ran unsuccessfully against Deval Patrick, was quoted in the Boston Globe saying, you know, he was asked about Scott Brown's appearance at the Cheap Trick concert, and he's like, oh, yeah, I love those guys. I've seen them 5 or 6 times. We may or may not have received yet another Gene Shaheen fundraising email citing his appearance at the Hampton Casino. She's raising money off of this. It seems to be effective. And some Republicans I've talked to said, look, like, we don't have anybody great out there. Scott Brown, you know, hypothetically could appeal to some independent voters, and he could raise national money, and it would bring attention to this race in a way that, some of the other people who are, you know, named as candidates won't.
Well, let's talk about one of those other names, if we could, Josh, and that's Jim Rubins, former state senator, most recently known for his work against expanded casino gambling here in New Hampshire. He's been pretty busy over the next couple weeks. He's speaking at picnics and lobster bakes and chili fests. Dean Spiliotis looks like a lot more than just exploring, even though officially it's still exploring.
Sure, and being an exploratory committee versus actually a campaign, that's sort of standard behavior as you ramp up. Yeah, I mean, all signs from what I've seen in listening to him is that he's planning on running. I think even someone under him who's a political veteran, he's run for governor, he's a former state senator from Aetna up in the Hanover area. Even someone with as much experience as him, kind of in the political culture in the state, it would be a tough race against Gene Shaheen. It'd be interesting to see how he positions himself in the primary, assuming that Karen Testerman or someone else challenges him. You know, he talks about conservative values, but he also sometimes talks about being a little bit more moderate than some of the folks in the Tea Party. And that would probably, in theory, stand him well in a general election. But of course, first he has to get through the primary. I mean, most people who know him in recent years, it's a lot to do with climate change. He's been involved in that. He was the head of the anti-gambling coalition in the state. So he's, you know, reasonably well known. And given kind of the bench that that Josh laid out a few minutes ago in terms of who might be running for different offices, you know, sort of a reasonable candidate in terms of his experience.
Okay, guys. So going from national offices to New Hampshire's State House, and Kevin Landrigan, looks like the state Senate has a new president. It is going to be Chuck Morse of Salem this week. The 13-member Republican caucus said, yes, we're 100% behind Senator Morse, even though senators don't officially vote next week. So, you know, you've got 13 people saying, yes, we're on board. It doesn't really matter in the end what the Democrats do. Is that correct?
That's right. Essentially, the choice of the caucus, since they're all together, and it wasn't clear until earlier this week that they would all come together behind Chuck Morse. But now that they have... it's just a formality when they meet on Tuesday to make the
choice. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I was wondering, you know, was there ever any doubt that Republican senators would unanimously support him, as they would need to do given that close Republican-Democratic split?
Yes, there was. There were two holdouts, actually. One of them was Senate President Peter Bragdon, and the other was Senator Andy Sanborn. It's interesting it would be those two holdouts, since when Senate President Bragdon won the presidency November in 2012, after the election, Andy Sanborn tried to mount a campaign to take him out, but backed out pretty quickly when it was clear that wasn't going to occur. Both Senators Bragdon and Sanborn insist that they weren't against Chuck Morse. They rather wanted, as a group, for all of them to meet and discuss what the agenda and what the priorities were going to be moving forward. Once that occurred, they got behind him.
Yeah, and Senator Sanborn is an interesting political figure, Josh. He's said to have political ambitions, perhaps beyond just being the senator from Bedford.
Well, I mean, people have talked about him running for governor. He certainly sent signals that that's something he's thinking about. You know, he made a cameo appearance. I mean, he's a bar owner, Concord bar owner. He showed up at the rally against the Bearcat vehicle, which we'll probably touch on later
in
the show, in Concord. You know, he's libertarian-minded, very pro-business. You know, first made a name for himself around the State House being one of the activists opposing the so-called LLC tax, and then, you know, lived in Henniker and served out of that district, and then moved to Bedford and managed to get elected there. And that surprised some people, that he did get elected in a district that he had essentially parachuted into. That's where he now lives. And he's got a lot of energy, and he certainly hasn't shied away from, you know, making his voice heard on healthcare issues. He's part of the Oversight Committee on the expansion of Medicare.
Right, and I do want to talk about Medicaid that in just a minute. The number here on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Join us. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're looking at some of the top stories this week in New Hampshire, looking at the early ramp-up to some of next year's political races. If you want to jump in on that, you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. Also, in a few minutes, we'll look at some of the issues being talked about at the State House this summer: Medicaid expansion, as Josh just said, and gambling regulation. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, before we do turn to some of these meaty issues that have been talked about at the State House this past week, I wanted to ask you about something that just came out this morning. And Dean, NHPR's Emily Corwin reported on a bill that passed this year, a new law now called the Auto Dealer Bill of Rights. But now a group of equipment manufacturers has sued. What's going on here? Give us some background first about this new law. Actually, Kevin, I think I'll turn to you first on that.
Sure. The Auto Dealer's Bill of Rights was sought by New Hampshire auto dealers because they were in major fights with major auto manufacturers about requirements with regards to their franchises. They complained that that the major automakers were requiring dealers to make updates to their dealerships, to buy products directly from them and not from in-state parts wholesalers, or where they could get the parts cheaper.
So not enough local control for
exactly
auto dealers, they felt.
And what they ended up with actually is probably the toughest auto dealer rights legislation in the country. I mean, it gives these folks the freedom for 15 years not to have to improve their dealership unless they want to. No other state has that kind of protection. These equipment dealers, equipment manufacturers, I should say, are included in this legislation. And that their argument essentially is that it's an unconstitutional restriction on free trade, if you will, that they're being, in other words, they're being brought under this rubric, and they're not allowed to essentially buy and sell their products at the prices they want to buy and sell under this legislation. This whole matter was considered by the legislature. The equipment manufacturers hired a lobbyist, brought them in, tried to get amendments that were offered to the legislation. They were overwhelmingly rejected, and now they've gone to the courts.
Okay, that's interesting, because 50 states do have these kinds of laws. So I was wondering why the manufacturers were upset. But you're saying this is one of the toughest
it is.
In the country. Josh,
well,
thoughts there?
The auto dealers have historically been fairly powerful around the statehouse. They spread money around to both parties. Everyone buys cars. They're powerful people in their local communities. And they did a good job on this. I mean, the manufacturers would say, you know, law prohibits us from selling directly to customers. There must be franchise holders. And so they're getting at that. And it will be interesting to see where this one goes. I mean, this went whipping through the legislature despite efforts of manufacturers to say you're going too far and meddling with contractual relationships we have with our franchisees. But, you know, to no avail. The votes in both House and Senate were vastly in favor of the auto dealers, and, you know, Governor Hassan was happy to sign it.
One last quick question for you all, and Dean, I'll turn to you. Medicaid expansion continues. There's been almost weekly hearings on whether or not New Hampshire should join the 20 or so states that have decided to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, and the 20 or so who've decided who haven't. Just put this in the bigger context, and then after a break, we'll talk more details.
Sure. As you mentioned, 23 states have decided to accept expanded Medicaid. This goes back to the Supreme Court decision that said states should have the option to decide whether or not to accept additional money, 100% funding for 3 years, 90%, I believe, after that, from the federal government to expand the Medicaid rolls. 23 states are accepting the expansion. 21 are not, and 6 are still debating whether or not to do it. We are one of those states where it's still being debated. This commission that's been meeting in advance of an October 15th deadline, I believe, had more hearings this week. Lots of healthcare providers testified, doctors, nurses, hospitals, community healthcare organizations, all uniformly pushing for an acceptance of the expansion.
All right, a little bit more on that after a short break. And we'll take your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page.
This is NHPR. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Congress reacts to the possibility of military strikes on Syria. House Speaker Boehner expects a whale of a fight over raising the debt limit, and then Syria's Assad vows to defend his country against any aggression. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Bernstein Schurer, committed to practical, innovative, and entrepreneurial legal solutions for clients in New Hampshire and around the world, in Manchester and at BernsteinSchurer.com. And PSU's Division of Online and Continuing Studies, helping you earn your degree evenings, online, and or days with a schedule that meets your needs. Plymouth.edu/DOCS. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we want to know what you think about some of the top stories this week. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And gentlemen, just before the break, we were talking about Medicaid expansion, and Dean Spiliota set it up for us, the context in which New Hampshire considers this decision. Kevin Landrigan, you were at the hearing this week at the State House. How much will this overwhelming testimony from the healthcare community that Dean described affect the way commission members see expansion?
I don't really think that much, and I think certainly the commission expected the testimony to be overwhelming. There was legislation that was sponsored by former Speaker Bill O'Brien to actually short-circuit New Hampshire's participation in Medicaid. A couple of hundred people showed up against the bill. He was there along with one other person in opposition. It is pretty difficult, after all, for people to come to a public hearing and say low-income folks should not have government-provided health care insurance. The turnout was certainly impressive, and it does indicate that there is this broad group out there that wants the expansion. Polls show that the expansion is supported by the public, but it's fervently supported by the provider community.
Well,
see a lot of money coming into this state to support health care.
One more quick question for you.
Sure.
You did mention that there were one or two opponents there, right Kevin, including some research presented by the group Americans for Prosperity. The research saying these providers could actually lose money if this happens. What was the response to this at the hearing among the healthcare providers and among commission members?
The healthcare providers essentially reject the assumptions that were made in the research. A lot of this is really about... And this is kind of the central debate that's going to occur when they try and cut a deal on expanding Medicaid between Senate Republicans who don't want to do it and Democrats in the House and the governor who want to, which is once you expand Medicaid, how many folks actually leave private insurance and go on to Medicaid? This study assumed a whole lot more people would be crowded out, if you will, of private insurance and go on to Medicaid. If that occurs, then hospitals would lose money because Medicaid pays a lower reimbursement for health care than private insurance does.
That's the so-called dumping issue. Not a very attractive word, but it does describe that private insurers might dump these folks into the Medicaid system.
And the Department of Health and Human Services actually estimates this crowd out, or this dumping, as you call, is only going to be about half as much, about 20,000 people, as this study that the opponents cited. Theirs assumes as many as 40,000 people will go from private insurance right on to Medicaid.
So like a lot of politically-minded research, it depends on the assumptions that you make going in.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about gambling, and that's another issue that's been talked about at the Statehouse this summer. A commission met yesterday, Josh, with a December 15th deadline to draft legislation. What's the question or questions, Josh, that this group is looking at?
Well, it depends on what members of the commission you're talking about. I mean, certainly there are a lot of people who are looking at, like, how can we get a gambling bill through? I think that's the main thrust of a lot of people on this commission. And, you know, some are looking at, there's always been questions about would the proper regulatory regime be in place if New Hampshire were to contemplate moving forward with a casino or with slot machines. And so those are questions that are being looked at. And what will get looked at the hardest is sort of a dusted off version of what was considered in the final throes of the budget.
A dusted off version.
It'll be, tightened and brightened potentially. And, there will be ongoing questions about the percentage of the take that the state gets versus a potential casino operator. That was something that sank the bill, one of several things that sank the proposal that was backed by Governor Hassan, in the sense among many that the casino company would be doing better than the state. And so those sorts of things are going to be looked at, and it'll be interesting to see how much Governor Hassan chooses to sort of put her shoulder to the wheel on this one. She obviously fought hard last time, and I would anticipate that she will be backing this again, of course, but how strongly we don't know, and it will a lot of depend on the financial issues. And Massachusetts is out there moving forward. Suffolk Downs has reached agreement with Boston, and that's going to go to a referendum, but they're talking about within 14 months of construction having some sort of facility going, and that'll be $30 million to the city of Boston and a $32 million payment to East Boston, something in that neck of the woods. And so that will, it will be interesting to see what element that adds to this debate.
And Kevin, you mentioned the pressure from Massachusetts as well in your article.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting the commission is going to examine that I didn't expect they really would seriously consider is whether the New Hampshire Lottery should actually manage the casino. As Josh remembers, this was a topic that was just assumed throughout this legislative debate on the casino bill, whether it was the governor or the Senate Republicans and Democrats who supported the casino. Everyone thought the New Hampshire Lottery would do it since they run the scratch tickets and the weekly lotteries, that they'd be the best folks to do it. But Attorney General Joe Foster raised the question, is this the proper place? So did Kathy Sullivan, a former Democratic Party chairman, a very close confidant to Governor Maggie Hassan. And I think the question really becomes for folks who support a casino, including Governor Hassan, Would it strengthen our hand to get a casino approved by this legislature if we created a robust enforcement entity to manage it? In Massachusetts, for example, it's a gaming authority that runs the casinos in Massachusetts, made up of former law enforcement professionals and people who have been in the finance and casino industry. Would that be the best way and the best way to put a casino bill foot forward next year?
I mean, I think it would seem to be a better way potentially, because at least it would be something new that you could say, see, we've addressed your concerns, rather than just the same old. So again, how robust and how vast that new regulatory authority would be remains to be seen. But there were legitimate concerns, I think, by critics of gambling that, throwing this all under the Lottery Commission when, they simply don't have people with experience doing that there now.
Yeah. And then on the other side of that, Josh, and I heard that too, on the other side of that, though, Kevin, from what I understand, some people said, look, we're New Hampshire, we're small government, we don't want to create a whole new entity.
Right. And there's a lot of confidence in the lottery's executive director right now, Charles McIntyre, former director of the Massachusetts State Lottery, former federal prosecutor. He came in 3 years ago at a time when the lottery was consistently not making its revenue target for almost 5 years in a row. Now, in the last 3 years, the revenue growth for this state lottery is in the top five in the country. And in all 3 years, we've more than made the number. So the legislative leaders I know are very reluctant to try and take this out of Charles McIntyre's hands. Is there a way actually to keep it in his hands, but perhaps surround him with a lot more law enforcement and casino experience in the administration?
All right. Well, this will come up again, and we will definitely, that's one thing you do know for sure about gambling, we'll definitely be talking about it again. But I want to move on to a couple other stories that caught my attention and the attention of us on the Exchange this week. And Dean Spiliotis, a Concord story that's ended up gathering statewide and even a little bit of national attention, and that's whether or not the police in Concord should purchase, with the help of a federal grant, so the feds would basically pay for it, an armored vehicle called a Bearcat. Now, what happened with this story this week?
Sure. Well, this is a $260,000 grant to buy this armored vehicle to replace an aging vehicle that is currently in New Hampshire. Earlier this month, there was a city council meeting in order to vote on whether or not to accept this grant, and the turnout was so large, it went on for 4 hours. They decided to delay a final vote until the council meeting on September 9th. So in the interim, Concord Police Chief Duval asked the Concord School Board to weigh in with a letter of support, basically asked the school superintendent, Chris Rath, to write a letter in support of the Bearcat. You know, the thinking is, you know, God forbid there's some sort of an episode at one of the schools in the city, this may be actually used to rescue students. Right. That's one possible use for it. And so they debated this in the Concord School Board, and they voted 4-2 not to weigh in. That originally they were going to send a letter commending the city council for its openness in consideration of the grant, but staying neutral, and now they've decided just not to do anything. And I think, in fact, they had sort of let it slide, and then Concord Mayor Jim Boulay sort of brought up the request again. The interesting thing from a national perspective is, you know, this really has, because the original grant mentioned Occupy Wall Street, sovereign citizens groups, Free Staters, Occupy New Hampshire, not Wall Street, but these citizens groups, and this sort of sparked this kind of social media-driven concern about, wasteful government spending, militarization of the police, infringement on individual liberties, kind of one of these sort of local stories that often kind of gets folded into the larger national debate. So we will ostensibly find out on September 9th whether or not the city council will take that grant.
Yeah, wow. So it's turned out to be a bigger story than just a simple thank you very much, Department of Homeland
and
Security.
And what's interesting
this to
me is I'm wondering if the original grant had not had those couple of lines about the citizens groups, if it would have blown up in the same way. I just don't know.
Well, we did a whole show on this issue, and the American Civil Liberties Union is, Dean, as you know, doing a whole project on this idea of militarization of police, so it kind of comes in that context as well. All right, and that's another story that will continue to play out, especially as that vote that vote comes ahead. Got a couple emails I want to share with you, gentlemen. And here's one that came in earlier from Christopher in Manchester. This gets back to our conversation, guys, about the second congressional district. Christopher says, I never thought Bill O'Brien could win in the second CD anyway. He might win a Republican primary, but never in a general. A Charlie Bass-type moderate Republican is the only type that can win in that district, which is much more liberal than the first CD. Christopher, thanks for the email. And Josh Rogers, your thoughts?
Well, I think there's something to that. You know, maybe Kevin can come up with somebody. I mean, when has there ever really been a fire-breathing conservative type in that district?
The last one was Chuck Douglas, of course, and he lasted two years, yeah. Remember, and Dick Sweat just swept him out.
Yeah. And so I think there's something to that. I mean, O'Brien, again, in a primary, you know, in particularly in a year if there wasn't a great turnout, you know, he might be tough to deal with under certain circumstances. But in terms of a general election, he'd be somebody that I think the Custer folks would have been, you know, happy to run essentially a, you know, campaign that was simply like, you know, Bill O'Brien is too extreme for New Hampshire. And that's what it would have been. And she would have been raised a boatload of money off of that. She's already an effective fundraiser. Whether or not the Republicans can come up with a so-called Charlie Bass type Republican, you know, remains to be seen.
Dean.
Yeah, and, you know, my guess is that the Custer campaign will run against the Bill O'Brien wing of the party, regardless of what Gary Lambert actually does. Yeah, you know, I've said all along, I've never seen the winning coalition in that district for someone like Bill O'Brien. It's just it's not really there.
The first CD is more
conservative. First CD tends to tend more Republican, but this particular CD, if anything, it's kind of pushed Charlie Bass to the center for those years that he was in office. And so it struck me as a very unlikely scenario that he could actually win.
Well, Christopher, thanks for that email. And here's another one from Lisa. This gets back, Kevin Landrigan, to the Medicaid expansion conversation that we had and your attendance at that hearing this week. Lisa says, about Medicaid expansion and people being moved onto Medicaid from private insurance. She says, I wonder if those studies take into consideration that some of the people with private insurance have large deductibles and qualify for free care through the local hospital. In those cases, I think the provider would make out better in the end. Thanks, Lisa, for the email. Kevin?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Certainly, people who have private insurance, some of them do get do end up in a nursing home, after all, if their deductibles are high sometimes and they're not able to afford a particular procedure. And in private insurance, we've seen deductibles generally go higher and higher. That is one of the reasons why there is this crowd-out phenomenon. I mean, the Congressional Budget Office, for example, estimated that if the entire country expanded Medicaid, 7 million people would migrate from private insurance to Medicaid as a result.
Well, again, thanks for that email, Lisa, and you, Christopher. And let's take a call. This is Mary in Northwood. Hi, Mary. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. It's good to talk to you and good to hear your show this morning. My question is about what I consider to be, you're talking about New Hampshire politics. And what I consider to be the most important question on the New Hampshire politics table this morning is, what is our congressional delegation going to do about more war in the Middle East? We have a constitution. It's the set of rules by which our government is supposed to operate. It requires that Congress, not the president, but our representatives in Congress, be the ones who decide whether we go to war. And I know we've gotten used to our presidents, you know, lobbing missiles hither and thither without a true declaration of war. But I want my representatives, Jean Shaheen, Kelly Ayotte, Annie Custer, I want them to go straight to Washington today.
Okay.
And sit in their seats and demonstrate that they expect to be called upon to debate and vote on more war.
Mary, thank you for the call. And this certainly has been a big headline recently in Dean's Bliotis. There was some coverage on NHPR about what our delegation is saying.
Yeah, interestingly enough, Mary anticipated what I'm going to be looking at in the next week, which is as we wait to see what the Obama administration is going to do with Syria and whether or not we have some sort of a missile attack. I'm increasingly watching our congressional delegation, which is taking a range of positions from, you know, on the one side, Carol Shea Porter saying that we shouldn't get involved, to Kelly Ayotte saying that under the right circumstances, we should most definitely have some sort of a measure there. And then Senator Shaheen and Congresswoman Custer kind of in the middle and sort of wait and see. And, you know, to Mary's point about the role of the president versus Congress, you know, there is a debate about in the Constitution that foreign policy is supposed to be kind of a joint exercise between the president and Congress. But in terms of the president acting unilaterally, you know, the train left that station probably 20 or 30 years ago. Presidents are loath to give up the unilateral ability to do things like missile strikes. They may consult Congress for public relations reasons, but most presidential legal counsel will say that the president has the right to act unilaterally, and they can often justify it by referring to like the membership in the UN or membership in NATO, so they don't need to go to Congress for approval. So this is a big debate. I don't think Obama is going to cede any power on that, much in the same way that George W. Bush or Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan didn't either.
Well, Mary, thanks for that call and question. And to you, Kevin Landrigan, I think Dean mentioned that's what he's going to be looking at this week, how New Hampshire's delegation responds to this. What are you going to be following and covering next week, Kevin?
Well, certainly expanded Medicaid is a topic as well. And the Gambling Commission, they're going to be looking at hiring a consultant and an in-state lawyer to advise them to develop this report on what the regulatory scheme should be.
So that's the big focus for you next week. Josh, how about you?
Well, I'm curious to see what comes out of the gambling also. I guess it's Labor Day weekend, and so I guess we'll see if we have more names to add to the list of our prospective candidates. I would assume top Republican told me I was pestering him about when are you guys going to come up with somebody who we can expect to really mount a significant challenge to Jean Shaheen. And you know, I was assured there was going to be a name coming out shortly that would be impressive, but I'm assured those sorts of things all the time.
So. Well, and certainly after Labor Day, things do tend to ramp up. So,
yeah.
Josh Rogers, thank you very much for being here. Appreciate
You're welcome.
It. That's Josh Rogers, NHPR State House reporter. Dean Spiliotis, good to see you. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Kevin Landrigan, thank you also for making the time.
Have a great weekend.
Kevin Landrigan, political reporter for The Telegraph of Nashua. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, with the start of the new school year, we bring you our earlier conversation on the new Common Core standards being adopted across the Granite State. Then NHPR President Betsy Gardella talks about the state of the station and the latest at NPR. And later we look at the difficult topic of elder abuse, how it happens, and what's being done to prevent it. Email us at nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show and the Friday News Roundup next at 10 on NHPR. New Hampshire weather partly sunny for most of the state today. Mostly cloudy from the mountains north. There could be some scattered showers and thunderstorms. Today's highs mid-70s to lower 80s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Gondwana and Divine Clothing Company in downtown Concord. Featuring over 70 brands of fashions, size small to plus for weddings every day and just for fun, gondwanashop.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning, it's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Steve Roberts of George Washington University, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. A bipartisan group of nearly 200 lawmakers are asking President Obama for congressional approval for military action in Syria. White House says the president has authority to make his own decision. A secret budget obtained by Edward Snowden and released to the Washington Post reveals new details